friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. And so, in conclusion, we recommend the following. After years of study, the National Academy of Sciences has submitted its report on what to do about endangered species. The message to Congress is simple. Don't stop. We'll have the story. Also, John Burroughs was a great man. Who was John Burroughs? We'll meet him in a moment. And the Nature Conservancy has one measure of success. Urban children visit the forest, only to return with a new spirit.
That's the biggest message, when I start seeing a kid being very gentle with those things, walking around a mushroom rather than step on it. So I look for those messages.
These stories, this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. And this is Bruce Robertson. A massive report from the National Academy of Sciences comes at a crucial time. A recently completed two-year study of the Endangered Species Act, prepared by a panel of the National Academy of Sciences, has been delivered to Congress and the White House. Titled, Science and the Endangered Species Act, the report confirms what many in the scientific world have been saying in recent years, namely that preservation of habitat is crucial for the survival of species. This was a novel idea at the time the report was called for 2 years ago by former Speaker Thomas Foley. However, the report is now available to a very different Congress than the one which requested it. Both the House and Senate are now busy voting away money and jurisdiction from the Act, replacing science decisions with monetary considerations. So the report stands in conspicuous opposition to most of what is now being heard from Capitol Hill. Dr. Michael Clegg headed up the panel which prepared the study. Clegg, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of California, Riverside, says the report makes some very specific recommendations.
One recommendation was to provide a broader conceptual framework for the definition of species as it is used under the Act, and we advance a concept called the evolutionary unit concept, which should make a more objective and useful distinction for biological units which should be eligible for protection under the law versus those which are not. Another recommendation was the one that we've already discussed, and that is that provision of habitat is essential for biological conservation, that species depend on an area in which they live, and if you deny them that physical and biological space, they will cease to exist. Those were two of the major areas that we dealt with in this report.
In recent years, newspapers, radio, talk shows, tabloids, public lectures, even arguments over a backyard family barbecue have thrashed the question of whether we are or are not in a period of rapid species extinction. And the question is not just academic, for the answer either justifies or repudiates political and scientific activity on behalf of life on Earth. Dr. Clegg, clutching his scientific hat, says the answer to this debate question is both clear and disturbing.
There are several things to separate here. The first is to get some appreciation for time scales. We believe that the Earth was formed about 4.5 billion years ago. Life actually began to evolve on the Earth close to 4 billion years ago. The occupation of the terrestrial environment, that is the land masses of the Earth, by life forms only occurred between 500 million and 600 million years ago. So that's relatively recent when you look at this grand sweep of time. All of the biological diversity that we see on the terrestrial Earth has evolved in that 500 to 600 million year interval. But that's a very long time when judged against the scale of human existence. Modern humans appeared within the last 1 million years or so, a very short interval in that time scale. Now, the time that is involved in the evolution of new species is also fairly long, on the order of hundreds of thousands of years or longer. So one of the questions that we would want to ask is, if we look at the history of the Earth in the last 500 million years, how do current extinction rates compare to those that we can infer from our knowledge of the fossil record? And when we do that, we find that extinction rates have been uneven in geological history. There have been approximately 5 episodes of major extinction in the last 500-600 million years. A couple of those have led to the mass extinction of major groups, like the loss of the dinosaurs is a classic example, and many of the reptiles associated with dinosaurs. Now, if we look at current extinction rates, that is the loss of species as a function of time, we conclude that the current rate is at least as high as any rate that has been observed in the fossil record. That means that current extinction rates approach or equal those of some of these catastrophic episodes in the past. The difference between today and the past is that the high rates of extinction appear to apply to virtually all organisms rather than just specific groups of organisms like the reptiles. And secondly, that much of the cause of high rates of contemporary extinction are due to human activity, or appropriating land for our own purposes. And so science seems to support the view that current extinction rates are among the highest which have been observed in the geological history since the occupation of terrestrial environments.
A long-winded answer, but clear in its message. Dr. Michael Clegg is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of California, Riverside. He chaired the National Academy of Sciences panel which prepared this report. Whether Congress hears the message and takes appropriate action is a very different matter. With daily reports coming in from the Hill about this or that cutback, it would seem current leadership is not concerned with this message. Or, as elected officials, are they but voting what we, the people, so stipulate? This is Bruce Robertson. You're listening to The Environment Show. Still to come, the inspiring story of John Burroughs and A Child's Walk in the Forest. If you'd like a cassette copy of today's program, phone 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 295. Many people request a cassette copy to catch up on back stories. Once again, the number 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Environment Show, program this week, number 295. Give me a robin in my own backyard any day. John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, even Teddy Roosevelt. These are names that glitter in the firmament of conservationists, their work largely responsible for much that we enjoy and treasure today. Lost in the firmament today is one who shone with equal brightness. Wendy Lutz spoke with contemporary writer Bill McKibben, who has edited a collection of essays titled Birch Browsings, the Collected Essays of John Burroughs.
They say that when he and Theodore Roosevelt, when Roosevelt was president, they traveled out west. They went on a trip to Yellowstone. And they say that, observers say it was very difficult to tell which of the two men was the more popular. They would come to a town and there would be huge bands to greet both of them and enormous cheers for both of them. Every school child had read Burroughs in special editions that Houghton Mifflin put out. He was a real literary hero in a way that I can't think of anyone comparable to at the moment, which makes his current obscurity all the more perplexing and all the sadder.
For over half a century, he stood among America's most prolific authors. Industrialists, poets, schoolchildren, even British royalty were fascinated by the landscapes he described. Today, however, naturalist John Burroughs seems all but forgotten. Much of his work is out of print. History books count his contemporaries, Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir, as the fathers of nature study and preservation. Yet one recent publication offers a reintroduction to John Burroughs and to his singular perception of the natural world. Birch Browsings is a small collection of original essays penned by the naturalist. Although the book fits in a coat pocket, perfect for a walk or camping expedition, its contents were chosen from Burroughs' collected works. According to author Bill McKibben, who compiled and edited the essays, this was no simple process.
The Riverside edition of his collected works runs 24 or 25 volumes and covers an enormous spectrum of travel and material and a lot of literary criticism, too. Burroughs was the great champion of Walt Whitman in the early days. I looked for pieces that most expressed what I thought was unique about Burroughs and most essential to him.
McKibben is comfortable in surroundings John Burroughs would appreciate, an old farmhouse echoing with children's voices and birds at the kitchen window feeder. Burroughs himself was raised in a small farming community at the heart of New York State's Catskill Mountains. Turning away from more dramatic vistas, Burroughs tramped its woodlands and streams for over 80 years. It was to this landscape, smoothed by plow, axe, and wagon wheel, that Burroughs devoted much of his writing. Bill McKibben.
Not a child of virgin forest and immense old-growth groves and things, although there were some beautiful woods and are some beautiful woods in that part of the world. Someone who really understood the margins, the places between civilization and wilderness, farmers' fields, old fields returning to woodlot, all that kind of thing. And of course, as a result, an enormous range of animal life and plant life, but everything from bluebirds and chipmunks and on up to all the larger creatures of the eastern forest.
Burroughs' special familiarity with the Catskills no doubt enhanced his essays with intricate detail. Such detail was key to Burroughs' philosophy as a writer and naturalist. As he stated in one article, fine print observations were essential to nature study.
The book of nature is like a page written over or printed upon with different sized characters and in many different languages, interlined and cross-lined, and with a great variety of marginal notes and references. There's coarse print and fine print. There are obscure signs and hieroglyphics. We all read the large type more or less appreciatively, but only the students and lovers of nature read the fine lines and the footnotes. It is a book which he reads best who goes most slowly, or even tarries long by the way. He who runs may read some things. We may take in the general features of sky, plain, and river from the express train, but only the pedestrian, the saunterer, with eyes in his head and love in his heart, turns every leaf and peruses every line. For my part, my delight is to linger long over each page of this marvelous record and to dwell fondly upon its most obscure text.
Over the years, says McKibben, Burroughs' affinity for nature's simpler offerings caused his popularity to decline, especially in comparison to John Muir.
I think it goes very much to that sense of the small versus the large. Muir, who I also love dearly and have written about, because of where he was living, Yosemite mostly and on the West Coast, had an incredible affection for the grand, for the enormous, for the huge scale nature operating. And that kind of caught our attention for a long time in this country, as large things should and tend to do. And that became the basis of a lot of the early conservation movement, preserving these fantastic treasures, especially of the West, Yosemite and Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon and Glacier and whatever.
Burroughs broke the naturalist's mold in other respects. No recluse, Burroughs enjoyed entertaining in his rustic cabin. His frequent guests and traveling companions included Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone. And though his generation had seen horses give way to automobiles, the western frontier conquered by railroad ties and barbed wire, John Burroughs wrote little of these changes. Yet Bill McKibben pardons Burroughs on some of these counts.
He was a person who got along with the world. He didn't have the kind of instinctive quarrel with civilization that we've come to expect from environmentalists, and then in some way is the legacy of Thoreau and of Muir. He was a very well-balanced, well-adjusted human being, and he thought, I think, that the world was going in a good direction, that things were getting better and better, and that and that's an unlikely viewpoint, we think now for environmentalists. And I think that he would have been appalled 50 years later to see what the results of Mr. Ford, Mr. Firestone's revolution was. Places that he loved turned into unpleasant suburbs, completely dependent on automobile transportation. He was lived at the last moment in which one could conscientiously be both a great lover of the natural world and a believer in modernity and progress in quite the sort of innocent ways that people did then.
In some sense, Burroughs' faith in industrial progress consigned him to lesser status in the environmental pantheon. But, says McKibben, John Burroughs should not be dismissed. Burroughs, with his appreciation of places between wilderness and civilization, is a vital counterpart to Muir.
I think that a healthy environmentalism will partake of both Muir and Burroughs. As people realize once again that the East is returning as a magnificent place, that it really in many ways has recovered or is recovering from the first waves of exploitation to hit it, as that sinks in, as we begin on the East Coast to understand that we have things of magnificence here, of great natural value, as that consciousness grows, so too will the appreciation and the understanding of Burroughs.
Out of the essays in Birch Browsings, John Burroughs emerges with an essential message. He provides more than a guide to the small wonders of the Catskill region. His gentle reflections convey a powerful sense of value to one's own backyard, wherever it may be.
You know, when Burroughs went on his first trip to Yellowstone, Burroughs was standing around, and it was a little too big and too grand for him, and freaked him out a little bit. And then he saw a robin hopping around. So this is the first robin I've seen since I left home. Where the robin is at home, so am I. And his equanimity was restored. And there's something incredibly wonderful about that, incredibly insightful, and in some ways harder for human beings than to appreciate Old Faithful, you know? Mm-hmm. It's important that we appreciate Old Faithful. It's probably even more important in the end that we appreciate robins.
Bill McKibben is editor of Birch Browsings, a John Burroughs reader, published by Penguin Books. McKibben lives in the Adirondacks, where he wrote The End of Nature. His new book, Hope, Human, and Wild, will be in bookstores this fall. This is Wendy Lutz.
Over 30 children have found an interesting and very effective way to beat the oppressive heat and summertime boredom of inner city life. We're deep in a forest glade of the Lysakil Preserve along the Mohawk River in New York. The preserve is one of many administered by the Nature Conservancy, where Marianne Marshauser, here directing the children, is head of environmental education for the local chapter. Marshauser says none of these children has ever done anything quite like this.
And most of them have never been on a hike before. And the only ones who had been, it's because they were on the hike with me last year. And so some of them, it's their second time they've ever hiked. Most of the kids have never hiked before. So basically just to get them out and give them experience. Our other hope is that they start looking at ways that they can preserve and, you know, have an impact on their environment. So hopefully the kids that leave start putting together the pieces of food chains, how you impact food chains, how does that ultimately impact humans? And everything that you do has an impact, you know, and so that's what we're basically trying to show the kids, and that's what most of the games are designed to do, is to get them to start making those connections.
The children arrive mid-morning by school bus. Some are admittedly afraid. Others hide their fear with a sort of boastful swagger. The morning is spent learning about native plants and some animals they might encounter. Their fear and resentment gradually turn to excitement as they actually find specimens. After lunch, in an open area, the group retreats deeper into the cool forest, there to spend the afternoon playing games. Marianne leads them through a series of interactive games to show how food and water supplies affect the health and population of animals. When food and water and shelter are abundant, the children learn, the deer population soars. A shortage of any of these elements, she calls them habitat components, causes the population to die off.
And then there's something eating the plant, something eating that. Maybe we eat the next thing, right?
Then
we can also change our food chains by doing different things. And we're going to talk about that after the game.
In another game, the children pretend they are various small plant and animal life. Here they are learning about the food chain. In order for their favorite animal to survive, they learn many other animals and plants lower on the food chain must also survive.
Almost every group that initially comes into the woods, the first thing they do is immediately start grabbing things and breaking things and picking sticks up, and they immediately want to destroy whatever it is that they're seeing. So our major goal is by the end of the day, they're not doing that, so that's the biggest sign to me, is as we're hiking, the first thing they want to do when we come across insects is grab it, squeeze it, kill it. And by the end of the day, hopefully, and generally we've seen it, by the end of the day, the kids are like, wow, look at this beetle. And they're very gentle with it. We talk a lot about how you handle insects and creatures that we've found. So that's the biggest message. When I start seeing a kid being very gentle with those things, walking around a mushroom rather than step on it. So I look for those messages.
When the children arrive at the preserve in the morning, they are asked how they think the land here should be used, a mall with amusement games, or left as a wildlife preserve. In the morning, 28 of the 32 kids wanted a mall. At the end of the day, gathering in a clearing ready to board the bus, Marianne asks the same question.
This morning before we started, when I told you what we all did, that a part of our job was saving areas like this, and I asked you guys how many thought we should just build an arcade or a store here. How many people think we should do that? Build a store or an arcade?
Arcade, yes, baby.
More.
That's arcade. 1, 2, 3, we have 4, 5. How many think we should leave it wood so that people can come here and look?
Do it.
Oh, good. I'm glad to see we changed a few minds today.
Of the 32 kids, 28 would see the preserve remain wild. Almost the reverse of the polling results from the morning. Marshauser says there is hope. Marianne Marshauser is director of environmental education at the Nature Conservancy, Northeastern New York chapter. She leads schoolchildren in environmental games at the Lysico Preserve near the Mohawk River. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Goodbye to Wendy Lutz, whose months of invaluable help will be missed greatly. Special thanks this week for the story on John Burroughs. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE.